Now
I can hear you now.
Whew. Okay, sorry about that, having some issues, you know.
Don't let it happen again, Vinny.
Yeah, issues like teenagers, that's what it is on the show, man. Everybody worried about their iPhones and their prescription medication that they steal out of mummy's closet. Okay, now William Klaus is my guest. He's the creator of the Kubrick Transformer. That was directed by Michael Bay. He was the co-host of Always Record with Alan Green and David Plait, and he's an author in the Sync Book 2, and he's a student of James Joyce and Marshall McLuhan. Now, who are James Joyce and Marshall McLuhan? I know who James Joyce is, but you'll have to refresh me, because I think it's been since I was like 16 that I last actually studied him in like high school.
James Joyce and Marshall McLuhan are two voices of the 20th century that seem to have seen further ahead and a much clearer vision than most thinkers. And I think they're very important to my understanding of just what the hell is going on nowadays. So
Marshall McLuhan basically clued you in to what's happening.
McLued in, media theorist. The key point about McLuhan for me is the idea of sense ratios and how different forms of media kind of play upon that. You know, like an equalizer for a stereo, Vinny?
Oh, yeah.
You know, a boring music listener, if all their levels are exactly straight in one line, correct? You want to get more bass in there, or maybe a little treble in there. But different forms of media, according to McLuhan, and I tend to agree with him, they move those levels up. So your eyes go up, maybe your ears go down, your taste or your smell or your touch. If you're a print-heavy human being, your equalizer is much different from somebody who is not literate, maybe an older society or a tribal kind of thing.
Well, I consider myself a bit of a treble maker, so I guess it's right up my alley.
A treble maker. You know, I'm just going to let him flow and nod. You're a master at that, my friend. So, yeah, so McLuhan keyed me into this whole idea of sense ratios, and I think this is where a lot of people kind of get their conspiratorial panties in a bunch, because they believe that this was done on purpose, and I don't believe it was. I think it's just a... it's the growing pains of a modern world. So,
So you don't believe in scumbaggery or backroom deals, lying? It's all coincidence.
I believe in scumbaggery. Humans do scumbaggery things, especially when money's involved. But that doesn't mean that it's a conspiracy. If you don't know about
definition,
it,
well, the definition of a conspiracy is really small and really quite simple. It's two or more people coming together to cause harm on another group of people without that group of people knowing about it. Almost everything's a conspiracy.
Well, okay, so I agree with that. No, don't get me wrong. I'm not going down that road of saying conspiracies don't exist. They do.
Oh, yeah.
It's just not the focus of my work or what I try to communicate, because I don't follow the news. Politics makes me sick. I figure 10, 15 years down the road from now is when I'll probably be able to stomach that stuff. So I don't comment on conspiracy. I know it's out there, but I just don't have any answers, and I don't have time for it myself with what I'm researching and what I'm working on. Sort of in that vein, okay?
Well, fair enough. Well, what got you interested in what you're doing in the first place?
You ever heard of instant karma?
Mm-hmm. I insulted one of my friends once when we were walking home from school, then walked it right into a lamppost.
Yeah, something like that, right? I had read a book by Terence McKenna in college. So we're talking about 1994. And this was probably, as you can guess by my college days, messing around with a fungus or two. And had my first psychedelic experience, and I read his book and the way he talked about it, and found a very clear and rational voice who explained a lot about what happened with someone I resonated with. Anyways, he had this thing called the time wave. It was something he constructed based on his psychedelic experiences. But how it emerged from – it came from coincidences, certain things that seemed to connect, but there was no rational reason as to why they connected. And so that book made me think about coincidences just in general. And for some reason, and I think a lot of people can speak to this, around that time, I started to notice this phenomenon that I would call basically instant karma. Whenever I knowingly did something, let's say, take something that I knew wasn't mine, or if a cashier gave me the wrong change and I didn't tell him and I walked out thinking, oh, you know, lucky me, instead of thinking, that poor son of a gun is going to have to pay that back to his business later. I noticed whenever I did those things, immediately after or the next day, something would happen that made me think karma was in action. Now, I don't say that this is scientifically proven, but I started to recognize that when bad things happened, I had a completely different psychological reaction to it if I didn't have something the day before where I felt like I was a douchebag. So it's this whole idea of things happening in conjunction, maybe there's certain meaning to it, made me take instant karma seriously, because with my psychedelic experience in college, I read about, you know, Eastern philosophy as opposed to Western philosophy. I started to integrate all these things in my life, and basically I felt like it was the universe saying, if you're going to start reading about karma, talking about karma, you're going to have to take it seriously, because karma is going to start taking you seriously. So I started to understand karma as it wasn't coincidence, that these were meaningful things happening for a reason. And I started to change my behavior because of that. After my whole experience and my understanding and grappling with instant karma, you know, I started to read about it more often, started to search for books that spoke to the subject. And I think the book that really opened my eyes and ears to the world around me, kind of waking me up, Vinny, out of my slumber, out of my television, fast food, video game kind of coffin, was a book called The Cosmic Trigger by Robert Anton Wilson. Are you familiar with that book?
Oh, I'm not familiar with really any books. I really haven't read a book in quite a number of years. I interview authors instead.
Yeah, you know, you got one side of the coin, but I highly recommend books. Books, pretty awesome. I read this book, The Cosmic Trigger by Robert Anton Wilson, and he mentions something about the 23 phenomenon. Have you ever heard of the 23 Enigma?
I've seen the movie, the number 23 with Jim Carrey, how 23 is in absolutely everything and it drives him freaking crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So a pretty dumb movie, pretty out there subject. But I was going through this in 1995, 96. I read this book. I'm learning about karma, coincidence, and all this stuff. And he relates this story about 23s. And just sort of like I had changed my behaviors and the sort of the wheels of karma seemed to tone themselves down because I was being less of a douchebag. I was opening my eyes. I was becoming more aware. These damn numbers started popping up in everything. 23s, just walking down the street, having a meaningful thought and looking up, and it's 2:30. It just sort of like the movie. Watching movies, seeing them on license plates, on doors, on meaningless objects in the background. It pulled me in with a just sort of a magical awareness. It really it continued to further the opening of my eyes and my ears and my chakras, as maybe people would say. It made me feel like a more aware and alert human being. And you know, if you're going to be alive today, you have to be aware and alert. So it seemed to me like it was a tool, you know, it was a tool for awareness. And every time you saw a 23, it was sort of like, I don't know if you've ever been to a meditation center where everyone's in rows and they're meditating and a Zen master will come from behind and smack you on the shoulders with a stick just to snap you back into awareness, to get you back into your correct posture. So these 23s became sort of like my Zen master in a way. Much like Instant Karma would wake me up to say, you know why there's a nail in your tire and it's flat right now? It's because you acted like a complete douchebag the previous day. It happened so much and so often that it sort of just forced my brain or my mind into a sort of Zen posture, a posture of awareness. And so with that book and with that 23 Enigma, I started traveling down a path that basically has landed me on your show.
Well, this is what I like about Alan and your work is it's based on synchronicity. Things actually do mean things a lot of the time, and sometimes it's just coincidence. And for you, the number's 23. For me, the number's 33, as in the 33 degrees of Freemasonry. And I think this last couple of days have been really big for me, so I'll be on the computer, and then somebody has mentioned something really amazing to me, like, wow, and look at the clock, and it's 33 minutes past the hour. Wow, that's interesting. And then I'll go to import a video, and the exact length of the video that I've imported is 33 minutes and 33 seconds long. And then I'll start processing that video, and the time that I look at it to see how long it's taking, it'll be at 33 minutes, and so on and so forth. It's become quite relentless. In the last couple of months.
I can't escape this
number.
Yeah, who's stalking who? Are you stalking the 33 or is the 33 stalking you?
I think it's a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B.
Absolutely. So for me, 23 in college was the number that really seemed to kind of open my eyes and ears to this phenomenon. In that book, Cosmic Trigger, I consider that book like a roadmap. Wilson assaults you with so much condensed knowledge and so many names and so many different avenues to go exploring. He talks about Aleister Crowley, Gurdjieff, Philip K. Dick, Terence McKenna, Antonin Artaud, R. Buckminster Fuller, Leary. He addresses subjects like magic, Kabbalah. It's just a grab bag of paths to take to fully explore the different dimensions of this phenomenon that we're talking about. So that was, at that certain point, sort of like almost like a Bible for me. I reread that and read it again. And then because of the glory of the internet, I was able to start buying books by these different authors and starting to read all this stuff. And it almost felt like I was joining a secret society because no one was advertising Robert Anton Wilson. He wasn't on TV. He wasn't in films. These books were not in most of the bookstores. You had to either find them in a random place or order it from the internet. And there was just this magical sense of belonging to a club. And I think the moment where it started to get really freaky for me was one night watching television at around midnight. You know the show Oprah Winfrey?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so it's the rerun of Oprah Winfrey. It's about 11:30 at night. And her guest is Jim Carrey. They start to talk about this film that is going to be released in a couple of months. And my jaw drops because he's explaining exactly what's happening to me. This journey of awakening, of the senses opening and trying to figure out that reality isn't exactly as it seems, right? So obviously this movie turns out to be The Truman Show. Pretty huge movie. A lot of people have seen it. Well, it spoke to me in a way that was sort of like, well, this is obvious. People who wrote this movie know Robert Anton Wilson and know these authors. They're in the club. But the moment that really freaked me out was when Carrey starts doing his wild man routine, jumping on the furniture, and then he runs and looks in the camera and says, Illuminati, Illuminati. And this is 1999, and I had only read about the word Illuminati in these books. So to hear Jim Carrey A member, so-called, of the club used that word on Oprah Winfrey really spun me for a bit.
Yeah, I do think that is quite interesting. Even the RZA, who's the one of the chief leads of what was it, the Wu-Tang Clan, I think at a Grammy Awards before he died, he goes and grabs the camera and he says, "The Illuminati are after me. The Illuminati are after me. They're trying to kill me." And then he turns up dead. We'll be right back after the break at the Vinnie Eastwood Show. .com. Don't get assassinated by the Illuminati before you get to listen to the rest of the show, ladies and gentlemen. You'll miss out on quite a bit, you know. That's the reason why I don't get assassinated by the Illuminati, because I just don't want to. I'll be right back.
What is about? There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about a little bit of history repeating. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go frickin' nuts. And I apologise to those of you who are listening who don't have a sense of humour. I pity you, in fact. My very special guest as well is William Claus. Is it pronounced Claus like Santa?
It can be, but usually it's Klaus. So.
Klaus. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Klaus, like the fish in American Dad. Okay. Well, welcome back. And what were we talking about? Sleep. You know, sleep's really important. Last night, one of these people commented on my Facebook status, right? I think my Facebook status was best buddies in prison can finish each other's sentences. And he says to me, what, a non-truth of status? This is about as common as a humane cop or a non-harp-inspired weather event. And, you know, looking back on it now, it was like, oh, it was a joke. But I actually took it the wrong way. You know how sometimes you're like, you know, you're real freaking tired because you've been up for, like, the last week trying to expose scumbaggery and get videos out and that kind of thing. And then somebody says something that's meant to be a joke and you just take it the wrong way and you just kind of blow up and stuff like that. And then when he reminds you, oh, bro, I was just joking, you go, oh, my bad. It's just, you do realize after a while that you've got to take ownership and responsibility for the things that you say and the things that you do. And you've got to understand that, hey, you make mistakes. It's like Mark Passio said, the three words that are required for reaching enlightenment. I was wrong.
Absolutely. I say them all the time. If you get on this path, you know, if you can't laugh, you don't make it very long because it'll drive you nuts. That's for sure. And I think, you know, when I was watching Jim Carrey scream Illuminati on the Oprah Winfrey show, that was the moment where I had my first test. I was like, this is just a big joke. I felt like I had wasted a lot of my time spending a lot of money on books, reading a lot of stupid stuff, because here was this big joke on a huge national television show, a big movie called The Truman Show. It was, you know, it was the universe and the world laughing at me saying, this is no big deal. You know, it was just, I felt embarrassed and I felt like I had been just taken for a ride. And I was pretty much ready to kind of throw away my books and just kind of go about my business and leave this whole coincidence, secret society, different way of thinking nonsense behind. I could keep the instant karma thing. I don't want to be a douchebag. But this path that I was climbing continuously on, it really started to kind of feel silly. Until I had what most people kind of call is like a sink experience, where something very profound and personal, but kind of mundane happened where it all kind of tied everything together. Yeah, have you ever seen the movie Dreamcatcher, Stephen King movie?
Yeah.
So I'm, I go to the movie store with a roommate, and I park my car in a handicapped spot because it's a thunderstorm. And the entire parking lot's full, and I said, we're only going to be in here for 3 minutes, and it doesn't really matter. No big deal. No one's going to complain. I won't get a ticket. Let's run in, run out. We'll make it out. So I put on my blinkers to, you know, pretend like my car is broken or whatever. Run into the video store, rent this movie Dreamcatcher. As I get out to put my car key in the door to make our escape, I drop the key down a sewer.
Oh, no, bro.
So, I'm standing there in the pouring rain. My car's got the blinkers on, and I'm in a handicapped spot. And it's basically the cops are going to probably arrive, give me a ticket. I'm going to have to pay for a tow. I don't have a spare key because I'm a moron. And the whole thing is going to cost me probably $700,
$800, $900. That's the universe fucking with you, yo.
And a week before, I had gotten laid off from my job. So, so I'm sitting there.
It just keeps getting better.
I'm sitting there, and I get inspired and say, no, there's a way. I can do this. For some reason, my roommate's a pretty big guy. He pulls the sewer cap off, but the thing is filled with water. I mean, the keys are submerged. But I, with whatever faith I had left, run into the video store. And I asked them if anyone has a broom, because I had a coat hanger. And I get this broom, and I try to wrap this coat hanger around the broom so I can maybe dunk it into the water and fish out these keys. Well, the coat, because it's pouring rain, the coat hanger does not stay on the broom, right? There's no traction for it. So I run in and see if anyone has any tape. By this point, they're sick of me. I'm soaking wet. I look like a lunatic. And they're pretty much done with my BS. I run to the car. I run to where the sewer cap is. I wrap this thing around as much as I can. I dunk the broom down, and I pull out my keys. It's just a one in a million shot. You can count the odds, but a miracle. It felt like a miracle for a schmuck who just got laid off and didn't have the money to pay for a tow. So I'm obviously pretty excited. We get in the car, we go home. I put on the movie Dreamcatcher by Stephen King. The first scene in that movie features a woman at a store. She goes into the store. She goes out to her car. She realizes she doesn't have her keys. She comes inside. She talks to the person who's behind the counter. The gentleman to her left calmly walks outside to her green car. My car was also green. He reaches into the gutter where the rainwater is, pulls out her keys, hands them to the woman. She drives off in her car. It was at that moment I got pulled 100% back in to this whole mystery of coincidence, because the movie called Dreamcatcher literally had just replayed what happened to me. Now, you can tear it apart. You can say it's not exact. You can say, you know, you're seeing what you want to see into that event. But having lived through it, it was as profound evidence as I'd ever had. It was like I had thrown it away, and then it had come right back to me and said, you need to continue to look at this phenomenon. There's something here that you need to learn. And it was funny. It was hilarious because it's absurd. To try to tell that story to someone, they look at you usually with blank eyes, with very little it's a non-event for someone non-involved. But the power of it subjectively is immense. It felt like the universe was on my side. It felt like the cosmos, that there was an order to things, that there was a reason for things. And this event told me to continue on with whatever it was I was dealing with. And I think it gave me this sort of, it gave me the freedom to just go with it And this is kind of where the James Joyce enters the story, because I found a book at a random bookstore in downtown Chicago called Coincidence by Robert Anton Wilson. And it's in this book he discusses how James Joyce structured pretty much most of Finnegan's Wake and his book Ulysses around the concept of coincidence. And it was at this point where, you know, I had the clown Jim Carrey with Illuminati and the Truman Show. I had the occultists and the freaked out seven people with Robert Anton Wilson and Philip K. Dick and Terrence McKenna. But now I had one of the greatest authors in all of literature somehow pulled into the story. And I had to start to integrate, how the hell does James Joyce fit into this crazy mystery of coincidence? And I think I read that book more times than any book in my life, because it, the essays on Joyce that Robert Anton Wilson has, they're just they're densely packed with a conceptual material that just tests every bit of your cognitive ability. And his source material is respected. So it's when you start to enter into sort of respectable material into this sort of comically jokey, almost comic book kind of body of knowledge, it starts to become more real. And I was thoroughly pulled back into the chase of this mystery with that book and bringing Joyce into the equation.
Well, it's good when things happen like that. They just pull you back into the mystery. And incidentally, it's 10:33:33 right now as I'm speaking. And you know, what it reminded me of is there was this dude named Shane Wenzel. He goes by the name of Tane Rakau, and he's down in suburban South Auckland. And what he does, right, is he goes to protests and he tries to recruit activists to come and work for him. And by work for him, he means he does all his work, and he runs his stuff, and he's trying to set up like this cult, basically. And I didn't know this at the time. And it was one day I was going down to my car, and something tells me, Vinny, you need to learn how to get into that car real freaking quickly, okay? You got to put the key in the lock, open that door, and open the and get in, and then shut it behind you, and turn the car on, and reverse it, and get the heck out of there as quickly as humanly possible. I don't know what was happening, and I did it so quickly that I actually cut myself like across the chest. The edge, the very top edge of the door was a little bit jagged, sort of thing. So I like opened it really quickly and cut myself across the chest. And then I think not a couple of days, maybe even a week later, we go down to this Wenzel character's place because we want to get the hell out of there. My friend, he's got a whole bunch of computer equipment there that he wants to get back. Wenzel wouldn't let him have it back. I was filming him. You know, we went down there with the full intention of exposing this psychopathic, violent piece of trash for exactly what he was. And I was filming him, and then he realized that I was filming him, so he kicked me out of the office, locked the door. And so I started filming from the window, you know, out of the darkness, and see him rough up my mate inside and catch it all on camera. And then they come out, and this big argument kind of ensues, and they actually try to like grab the camera off me and try and delete the footage and things. And my mate stands in front of them and he says, "Vinny, go for the car. Go for the car. Put the key in the lock. Open the door. Get it out of there. Put the car in reverse. Get my mate in there." And then we're out. We're gone. And it was just that moment that I recalled what had happened a week previous, that something was trying to prepare me, something was trying to look out for me, something was trying to keep me safe. And I think it was at that point that I recognized a lot of the importance of what it is that I do, and how I've never worked for anybody since. That was another really important lesson, is that if you get involved with people and if they perceive that you're underneath them, that's something that completely disagrees with me whatsoever. I never work for anybody again. I work with people and with people only.
That's you're lucky if you can do that for the rest of your life. Most of the world doesn't have that privilege, but you got to fight for it, right? You can't just be a passive person and expect that kind of freedom. So, yeah, I applaud. That's definitely the goal with most employment. We got to do it for a long time, most of us, right?
Well, you know, nobody actually has to do it. I mean, oh, wait, no. I don't know anybody who's never been employed, who started off their own business like straight off the bat and then started off being self-employed. I don't know anybody who's done that. I do know that my first job was writing, directing and producing and putting on a play with like about 14 teenagers and things like that to raise money to go to university. I remember that. And I'd never had a job previously before, and that kind of taught me a lot about organizing and things like that. But other than that, every single employment opportunity that I've ever had in my entire life has turned out to be the worst for me. You know, I mean, I've learned some really harsh lessons, and people have just taken advantage or been douchebags or something like that. And I just realized that, hey, it's not me that's actually at fault here. I was actually really good at doing all of this stuff. I was actually really honest and decent and had integrity. It was actually people who employ people that are the problem. It's having a job that is the problem. It's being a slave that is the problem. Never again. Never again. And so, you know, after a number of bad experiences, I developed a I've got about as much evidence for this as every single psychological condition in the diagnostic statistical manual, meaning none. I call it employophobia, because I'm very afraid of being employed, and it's just for this very reason. No employer has ever truly appreciated me and given me just rewards for my unique talents and skills. So hence, I become independent and reward myself for my own talents and skills, and it is in itself its own reward, because I get to help people who really need to have media coverage and so on and so forth, and get to talk to very interesting people like yourself about important stuff that actually matters. All right, we'll be right back after the break at the Vinnie Eastwood Show with William Klaus. Back in a minute.
Ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor. Believe what you want, but my evidence is greater. What you know about the Bilderberg and New World Order? What you know about the real fluoride in your water? What you know about the breed of uranium in the mortar? What you know about AIPAC controlling the reporter? What's wrong with the world? People kill people that other people command.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about keeping it bangster. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. We gamble on the stock market and so on and so forth just to make sure that the bank accounts are kept full of illegal Illuminati money. And there really is Illuminati money in the States, isn't it? You know, because you've got the all-seeing eye of the Illuminati on the back of every $1 bill. Hey, and I was just wondering, is it just the $1 bill, or is that great seal of the Illuminati on every single note?
Just the one.
Okay.
Just the $1 bill.
Because yeah. It's the most common, isn't it?
Well, it's just it's the start of something big, right?
Oh, yeah.
You got to lead off with your hidden symbols on the number one, so.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about instant karma, and I just made myself an instant coffee. I think there's a little bit of synchronicity in there. And I've also become really attuned. Have you noticed that how once you're aware of synchronicity, you're actually capable of tuning into it and it becomes a lot more intense? It happens more frequently and you're capable of interpreting it faster and more explicitly. Have you noticed that?
100%. I think... You know, this kind of ties in nicely to where I'm at with this because, you know, it's one thing to wake up and realize that there's conspiracy in the world, right? That things aren't what they seem in the government. Politicians generally are just painted faces saying things that are not necessarily the most honest truth. That, you know, this conspiracy exists in the structures of the world, but this mystery of coincidence and synchronicity is the conspiracy of your own mind. That if you can't trust your own mind to process information correctly, then how are you going to speak to the conspiracies in institutions or in other people? And really what this story I'm telling is my recognition and realizing that my brain and my mind, there was a conspiracy going on there, and that these little coincidences and synchronicities were these methods to wake up myself, to look inward and to try to reprogram the original operating system that I was born with or I was given by my culture. So that if I wanted to attack conspiracy, if I wanted to enter into a deeper field, that I could have sort of the psychic equipment to be able to do that to the best of my ability. And I think that sort of reprogramming or that understanding of the operating system that you're born into, it's a short journey for some people. Some people just figure it out and they move on. I was born a Catholic, so it's been very, very difficult and challenging for me to sort of override my Catholic operating system that I was born into.
It was really easy for me to override my Catholic system that I was born into because Mum stopped buying me ice creams, and that was the only reason I went to church. You know, have you noticed that the Catholic Church is based on bribery? It still exists today.
Well, you know, this is the thing, is that I was a pretty bright kid. I definitely distanced myself from my peers as far as where my intelligence level was as a young kid. So I was actually able to, when at church or when confronted with the Bible, read these things from an early age and to process whatever it was that they were trying to communicate. And you take away all the corruption of the church, right? And you take away all the corruption of, you know, the institutions that abuse it. When you get down to it, the Catholic system is heavyweight. It's a beautiful, intricate system that when understood in-depthly can really inform your reality in a positive and beautiful way. You can become a very, very powerful and in touch and in tune person. Saying in touch in Catholic in the same sentence is probably not a good thing, but you can become really in tune to the universe, right?
And I've got a great example here. There was this Catholic preacher, or I'm not sure if it was Catholic. I don't remember. It was just basically, you know, one of these really massive televangelist kind of cult-like leaders, right? And he's sitting there and he's like pretend masturbating on stage by polishing this rod, and it's just like there's this dude who's watching this video. I think it's like it's called the creepiest preacher ever or something. And he's like, when you pretend masturbate on stage, that's a hint. <You know? laughs> he's just sitting there ranting and bashing this guy and bashing Christians for stupidly, you know, falling in line and following these kind of people. And then he says something really profound. He says, if you want to be spiritual, read your frickin' Bible. Don't get somebody else to interpret it for you. Read it yourself. Read a book. What is the problem here? You won't get deceived because the book ain't trying to deceive you. It's trying to tell you the truth. And only people who read it and interpret for you even have the possibility of deceiving you with it. So just read the frickin' book.
Read the book, Vinny. Read the book. It's a good book. It's got some garbage in it. Most books do, but nothing's perfect. Nothing can be perfect, you know what I mean? It's just, it's the way things move, the way things change. That's why we have change in this world. So, yeah, no, I agree with you. Synchronicity and coincidence and instant karma, this is a spiritual journey. And what was nice is that when I turned that lens onto the Catholic operating system that I was born into, I realized that it wasn't all bad. What I was rejecting was just the corruption and the crap that comes with all that money. But really at the heart of it, real solid discipline, definitely made me the person I am today. But, you know, this this process of carving off sort of the tumors that grew into it, it was what I was going through. And it was nice that I didn't have to lose the whole thing. You know what I mean? I didn't have to completely reject and renounce Catholicism, which is which kind of feeds into this whole thing with Joyce, right? James Joyce. You have a Catholic with Joyce, and that informs a lot of his struggle and his spiritual awakening. And really, when I fell into Joyce and this book, Coincidence, by Robert Anton Wilson, I was stuck. I was stuck with Joyce, and Joyce is pretty impenetrable. I could not make sense of the actual texts of Joyce. Ulysses was boring to me. Finnegan's Wake was just a jumble of nonsense to me. Wilson's telling me that it's genius. It's informed by genius. It's informed by maybe the greatest mind of the 20th century, but I was just completely stuck. I started to buy books about Joyce and about Finnegan's Wake and about Ulysses. I bought the annotated Ulysses, but I wasn't getting that crackle of excitement with where I was at. And I remained stuck in that period for a couple of years, maybe about 4 years. I just wasn't really progressing, but I still kind of went back to it and tried to kind of get under the surface. And why was Wilson so excited about Joyce? And then, you know, it's kind of silly, but I became more savvy at the internet, and I started to find blogs and message boards, and I became more interactive with the internet. And that's when I found two websites that completely changed my life. And it's not an exaggeration. The first one was a website run by Lorenzo Haggerty. It's called the Psychedelic Salon. And he runs a podcast where he broadcasts lectures. And he had, at that point, I think it was about 60 lectures in his podcast series, but he had about a 10-episode series of Terence McKenna lectures. So where I begin this tale was in college, reading Terence McKenna. Now I'm starting to hear Terence McKenna speak. And so I find Psychedelic Salon run by Lorenzo Haggerty, and I start to hear the lectures that McKenna gave. And then I found this other website. It's a blog called The Secret Sun. And this is run by a guy named Christopher Knowles. And it was in tandem, this podcast and this blog, that started to crack open or chip away at this impenetrability of Joyce and sort of the concepts that I was dealing with at this point in my process. And if you want to know, you know, I had thought of blogs as a four-letter word at that point in my life. They seemed like the denizens of the geeks and the misfits and the fringe and the throwaways. And in about 4 months, I became a dedicated follower of The Secret Sun and a handful of other blogs. And it was people who were writing and especially comment sections on the blogs. It was like the others. I don't know if you know this quote by Timothy Leary, turn on, tune in, drop out.
Yeah.
But the follow-up to that, someone said, what do we do after we drop out? And Timothy Leary says, find the others. Find the others. And that's what I found with the Psychedelic Salon and the Secret Sun. I found my others. It had taken me a long time, and I wouldn't have found it without the internet, because the subject matter wasn't the stuff that I felt real. My sanity seemed to be exposed when I would bring up these concepts in conversation with regular people. There was a certain safety with the internet, and I started to make comments on these blogs and started to interact with the internet, and it was one of the more exciting periods of my life, is discovering all these other people.
And we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after the break with William Klaus. Don't you go anywhere. Back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which, according to the Prime Minister, is good for the economy, because now everybody can get a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. And my very special guest is William Klaus. Welcome back. And we were talking over the break about, how do I control my swearing? And yes. Is it because I'm a pro now? Occasionally stuff slips out. And what's interesting is because I'm sort of jovial in this, and the show's kind of fun. My guests tend to swear on this broadcast quite regularly. They just feel comfortable enough. Hey, Vinny's, fun, and let's just say the F word and that kind of thing. And I always have to apologise to the affiliates and then tell everybody about the FCC regulations, and then I have to remind the FCC that I want to say to them F you, and that kind of thing. So. It's a process. I think it took quite a long time before I was able to really get control of it. And every now and again, something will slip out, in a pregnancy type of way, and afterwards there's ironically a pregnant pause. Now, kind of like a cat with kittens.
Exactly.
Pregnant pause.
Yeah. So where were we?
I don't recall. I think we were talking about... Wait. Actually, over the break, we were talking about how seven people might need to say something to you before it'll register. And you were saying that you really appreciated the opportunity to get on and tell your story and say, well, everybody's got a story. And there could be, right now, listening to this, a dozen people or so for whom... six people have already talked to them about something like this that they've ignored, and now they're suddenly getting it. Now the penny is dropping, and I think that's really beautiful. That's what the show's really about, man. Just let people tell their story, and you never know what the positive ramifications might be.
Yeah, you just gotta project it out there, give people a chance. And that's what I think these blogs and these podcasts were. That I had sort of ignored, and I probably had people recommending a blog or a podcast 4 or 5 times, but for whatever reason, I broke through into a certain community online, like I said, through Psychedelic Salon and The Secret Sun. And like I said, I can't stress enough how important The Secret Sun and Christopher Knoll's work was, because he was doing something so profoundly in touch with whatever spiritual path I thought I was on, because he was putting out content of such a high caliber for free. This was the type of material written at such a high level with such insight and with such passion about the subject matter that it was so compelling to know that someone was putting this out there for free just to get the message out there. And I cannot thank his contributions enough. Because I would pay $50 for an old Crowley book or $35 for an out-of-print Robert Anton Wilson book. And Christopher Knowles was writing a material that was just as important, and it was free, and it was daily or 5 times a week. And plus, to take this to the next place, was he was putting other authors, other bloggers on his page that were sort of friends of the tribe kind of thing. And this is where I discovered a blog by a gentleman named Mark LeClaire, who blogs under the name The Wrong Way Wizard. And it was Mark LeClaire's work on Stanley Kubrick at his website that took me to the next phase of this journey.
I've had Mark on the show.
He is eloquent, has a great sense of humor.
The coolest thing about him is he smokes a pipe. while he's on webcam during the show. It was great. It was so wizardy, bro. So wizardy.
Ultra wizard, bro. Yeah, Mark's great. And he put Stanley Kubrick on a pedestal saying that this is important. There's something about Kubrick that you need to investigate. And this is where I sort of linked a chain, because as I started, because I had seen Kubrick's movies growing up. I had seen 2001 as a 10-year-old on cable with the monkeys. I had seen Full Metal Jacket. I had seen The Shining, a movie that I hated. I had read Stephen King's book and thought that the movie adaptation was horrible. It was boring. I didn't get it. It made me feel creepy in a way I didn't know, but I rejected it. So I was like, how does Kubrick enter into this mystery? And as I started to study Kubrick, I realized that, okay, 2001, A Space Odyssey. James Joyce's number one novel of the 20th century, Ulysses, is a retelling of the Odyssey, right? Also, in a quote by Kubrick, he says that in 2001, A Space Odyssey, I have convoluted Marshall McLuhan, where instead of the medium is the message is the medium. So now all of a sudden, I have this sort of, I've cracked the seal of this impenetrable figure in James Joyce, and I have this line that goes, Kubrick, Marshall McLuhan, and James Joyce. And Marshall McLuhan was a James Joyce scholar for his early career. And for some reason, now all of a sudden, I have Kubrick, Joyce, McLuhan. And I have these, it was the damnedest thing, because it just broke down the wall.
Somebody threw a Kubrick through your window.
Another Kubrick in the wall, my friend. And Mark LeClaire at The Wrong Way Wizard was writing about this subject matter at such an elite and insightful level that I feel like I leapfrogged from first grade all the way into college. I just felt like it was at the right place at the right time, and I started to really figure something out where I had for about 4 years been completely stuck. And the engine started to roar up again, and I all of a sudden had this new Corvette instead of the rusty old Chevy jalopy that was on a cinder block in my driveway. And I jumped into this machine that was
like
gifted
a DeLorean.
To me. Yeah, absolutely. 88 miles per hour, brother. And I just took off. And it was the beginning of 3 years of just intense study and reawakening and fine-tuning my psychic lens. You know, it was going from standard definition into 1080i. You know, it just was high-definition time. And I started to...
Do you know what the difference between ADD and ADHD is?
I don't, Vinny.
The picture quality.
Well, I'd rather have the ADHD, I think. How about you? What do you have?
Honestly... I've got 3D.
3D, baby. Well, this is all about 4D, man. This is the fourth dimension. This is what they're talking about. This is what Joyce was tapping into at the beginning, turn of the century. And you see this in the surrealists, in Dali and Picasso and Relativity. You see this understanding of how the fourth dimension is trying to be communicated in media and trying to basically, it's attempting to program your operating system through television, film, and music and propaganda. And McLuhan is diving into this. And Kubrick is basically saying, well, if Joyce got there with literature, I'm going to go there with film. Because if it can be thought, it can be filmed. And this was sort of like the textbook of the 20th century. This is sort of the conspiracy of your own mind and saying, I'm going to take the reins on this and I'm going to start programming my own operating system. I'm not going to be content with the one that was given to me. And out of this absolute fast track that I was on, I started a email dialogue with Mark LeClaire that would lead me to this thing I call the Kubrick Transformer, which in a nutshell is sort of like a media-based evidence of the fourth dimension's relationship to the third dimension. It's a dream catcher. It's something unexplainable and something that forces you to find an explanation for it, because it is the ultra weird right there in front of your eyes and ears. And it was sort of basically 12 months of off and on, sometimes more intense, sometimes less intense, of research and talking with Mark LeClaire that led me to this Kubrick Transformer thing. And the name does not reference the Transformers in the sense of the Hasbro toys or the movies. It's more in line with a guy named Maurice Cotterell, who wrote some pretty amazing books. One of them, The Tutankhamun Prophecy, which if you buy that, he shows these photographic overlays where he takes a picture of a Mayan mask, a jade mask. And when you overlay the photograph of these things and you manipulate them, certain images start to sort of project out of it. And there's a narrative that he says falls in line with the Mayan cosmology. And whether or not the Mayans did this on purpose or whether or not it's a coincidence, regardless, when you stare into this thing and you receive these images, this narrative starts to emerge. And it's fully in line with all of the research that Cotterell presents in his books. And it tells this story. And it's in this story that sort of informs, at least it informed me and gave me a better understanding of the fourth dimension's relationship to my third dimension. And so I named this Kubrick Transformer in honor of the research that Cotterell puts out, because he's another person who I think who puts his research out there so bravely and so profoundly, and is giving the reader and the public the opportunity to, you know, shut him down as a lunatic on one end, or to praise him beyond an appropriate level as a messiah or a genius. But regardless, the work is there. He puts itself out there, and I think it's brilliant. It's brilliant. So the Kubrick Transformer was named in honor of Maurice Cotterell. So brilliant guy.
I'm still a little bit confused as to what the Kubrick Transformer actually is or what it actually does.
Okay. So in this conversation with Mark LeClaire, we shared a love for the combining film with music. Kubrick, as a director, said he directs more like a conductor, that music is just an integral part of the cinematic experience as anything. I'm sure you've heard of the Pink Floyd Wizard of Oz phenomenon.
No, but I've heard of the Who Matrix phenomenon.
Okay, Andras Jones, a good friend of mine. Well, not a good friend of mine. Well, he's a friend of mine. I've talked to Andras on occasion, and the Matrix, the Lifehouse Matrix, is a perfect example of this. I learned about it through Pink Floyd and The Wizard of Oz. When I saw it, I became a full-blown – I was obsessed with it. Most people think of it as a stupid stoner trick. People see it once, they laugh, they forget about it. Other people don't laugh at all. They just find it boring and a waste of time. And those are all very valid criticisms and assessments of it. But for me, playing Dark Side of the Moon while watching The Wizard of Oz triggered something in my head that was like, this was an example of this thing that I was chasing, this mystery. And LeClaire shared this obsession. He saw the same thing in it that I saw. So we started to kind of compare notes with combining certain films with certain albums. So one of the ones is you play Pink Floyd's Echoes to the Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite section of 2001. And there's some claims that Pink Floyd scored that piece of music for Stanley Kubrick because it just seems to mesh so well with the images you're seeing and the music you hear. It's undeniable, seemingly, that they go together. There's some transference there. I shared with LeClaire an experiment I did. I had quit drinking for about a year. I had quit smoking marijuana, and I was as stone sober as they got. And about a year and a half into that period of my life, I decided, well, I got some marijuana, and I was interested in smoking for the first time in a long time. And I decided to take a walk, and as sort of a joke, I decided to, why don't I go to a movie in a movie theater with headphones? Why don't I watch a movie I had never seen before in the theater with Dark Side of the Moon on my headphones and just see if it works? Will it be entertaining or will it be boring? And I said to myself, within the first 15 minutes, I'll know if it's boring. And if it's boring, you know, I lose $8, you walk out of the theater, but big deal. You know, it was just sort of a media experiment. So I'm walking to the movie theater. I have my iPod and my headphones. And I roll one up, and I smoke. And as I'm paying for my ticket, I felt like the biggest fool on the planet. It just was the most absurd thing in the world. And I almost backed out of the experiment right then. But I said, all you're going to lose is $10 or $8 or how much the ticket was. You'll lose 10 minutes of your time, and you'll just be done with it. So I walk into the theater. I press play whenever, I don't know, I just, whenever it seemed like the right way, when the Warner Brothers logo was going to fade away or whatever. So this is Harry Potter 6. I forget which one it is. You know, I haven't read the books. I've never seen the movie. I sit down. I'm stoned. I listen to The Dark Side of the Moon. And next thing I know, 2.5 hours or 2 hours and 20 minutes go by. And it was one of the single most entertaining experiences of my life. There was obviously no intention between what I saw or what I brought out of the experience. It was just this merging of film and music. And like I said, it was thrilling. There were moments that kept reoccurring throughout this experience that mirrored the kind of exciting things of Dark Side of the Moon and The Wizard of Oz. And as I left the theater, I was sort of right there in the middle of the mystery again. All these coincidences that were occurring between the words and the music were ridiculous. And so I discussed this with LeClaire, and we began this search.
All right, we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with more buzzy experiences, no doubt, from William Klaus. Back in a minute. Don't you go anywhere. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the most sleep-deprived 2 hours in talk radio. I don't know, what's the longest you've ever gone without sleep, ladies and gentlemen? You know, it's been a hectic couple of weeks. I must tell you, for me, William, let me introduce you. I cut together 3 documentaries in 3 days. All right. 5:45 a.m., 8 a.m., and midday. Those were my 3 bedtimes, 3 days in a row. Oh, my God.
I don't know if coffee's strong enough, brother. I don't know if coffee's strong enough for that.
Well, I had not only coffee to fuel me, I also had copious quantities of rage because I'd stopped smoking weed.
Rage, baby. I love rage.
It's surprising how much anger can fuel you. And you know what? What can I say? What can I say? You get real angry, and you get a hell of a lot of energy. You know, you see fluoride being put into the water, and these people coming out and exposing it, and they get editorials beating the crap out of them in the media. That effed me off so much that I stayed up till 8 o'clock in the morning editing these videos to get their message out there. Another friend of mine, Russell Malcolm, he has his home and his business invaded without a warrant, and they destroy his complete business, put 8 people out of work, and kick him out of his house as well because he's exposing corruption at the local Auckland City Council. And then you got this other guy, Paul Waddell, who's one of only 3 people who's qualified in the country to test for electromagnetic radiation and EMF frequencies, that kind of thing. And, the room that he gets to do his conference at this big, you know, organics expo is surrounded by all of the other stalls and all of these people walking back and forth, completely interrupting it and that kind of thing. So, you know, with my editing prowess, all 3 of these people... and all their stories, well edited, finally get out there with correct audio, with correct visuals, the slides and everything cut in perfectly, and it's just like, yeah, I did it. I did something that nobody, I don't think, on Earth has ever done before.
It's a great feeling.
Mm-hmm. And the best part about it was I was helping people who could not do it. Okay, I had the skills and the abilities to do what I can do. They had the skills and abilities to do what they could do. But it was only once we complemented each other that we actually managed to create something that was actually meaningful, that was actually valuable, that could actually help people.
Absolutely. It's almost the only thing we can do, right, Vinny?
Yeah.
It's what, I mean,
if you're not helping people, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah, you're just helping yourself. Yeah.
I am you, another me, or something like that. Is that the Mayan saying?
I think so.
Yeah.
Namaste.
Yeah.
Well, you know, spiritual bumper stickers are great, but, you know, you got to go beyond just a word sometimes. You got to go deeper. And, yeah, you know, it's collaboration. It's collaboration with like-minded people, and that's what the internet gave to me. It was the ability to work with someone like Mark LeClaire, because without the internet, I would never find someone so in tune with what I was thinking, and I would have never made what I felt were huge leaps in this spiritual journey. And God bless the internet. It's transforming our reality faster than we even know.
Transforming it into what? And this is another thing, blogs. Where does the term blogs come from? Does it come from the term Joe blogs, and that's where it comes from? You know, because that's who is doing the blogging. Just average people, Joe blogs.
It's a shorting of web log. So like a log, like a diary. It's a web log, and so web log is weird. Blog, people like it. It's funny, you know. A 4-letter word.
Reminds me of Ren and Stimpy. It's blog, blog, it's big, it's heavy, it's wood.
It's like the log lady in Log Lady in Twin Peaks.
I haven't seen that.
Oh, you'll love it. It's weird. How do I share this obsession about Pink Floyd and and Wizard of Oz, or, you know, Pink Floyd and Kubrick? Me and LeClaire were seeing the same things. We discussed this whole phenomenon, what we're seeing in it. We're collecting evidence on the internet that suggests that Kubrick was, in touch with what Roger Waters and Pink Floyd were doing with their music. Obviously, Roger Waters and Pink Floyd were aware of Kubrick. Was there any, collaboration directly between them? They seemed to have a very public feud. You know, we argued about whether or not this was intentional or this was just coincidence or evidence of something greater. And if it is evidence of something greater, just what is that and how does it relate to McLuhan and to Joyce and to this whole mystery and this whole path that I was going on? So we started playing most of the Pink Floyd albums alongside most of the Kubrick films. And, you know, it's one thing to be convinced in your own mind that this is working. It's another thing to have somebody all the way, 2,000 miles away agreeing with you and bringing up similar insights and similar things that are basically transferring between this sort of what I call media alchemy. You know, we're mixing ingredients and trying to come up with a new ingredient. We're mixing film with music and coming up with a new narrative or a new experience. So this media alchemy that we're doing, we're kind of finding that we're having objective results, that it's not just this one single individual subjective experience. There's something that we're both seeing. And we basically isolated three Pink Floyd albums that all seem to work with three specific Kubrick films, Metal, The Wall, and Dark Side of the Moon. And the three Kubrick films were Eyes Wide Shut, 2001, and The Shining. So The Shining was interesting because I hated that movie. But when I watched The Shining while listening to Pink Floyd's album Metal, I found it to be fascinating. There was something about the narrative that I wasn't seeing when I just listened to the standard audio track. It was as if the soundtrack of Pink Floyd allowed this narrative that was embedded within the film to sort of jump out. And so as we discussed this fact that these albums and these three albums and these three movies seem to have so much in common, LeClaire, who's a brilliant mind, way beyond mine, started to discuss with me sort of a mathematical theory of why this might occur. I don't think I was able to keep up with him. His intellectual ability was beyond mine, but I could help him with his research. Long story short, our communications seemed to break up at this point. We just weren't on the same level, even though I think he appreciated my input and I respected his vision. And we kind of started to drift apart in our research and our ability to share insights into this phenomenon. But then because these three soundtracks and these three movies seem to be interrelated, I came up with the idea of why don't I play all three movies at once and play one album. If I'm as crazy as doing what I've been doing before, this next step ahead, I figured I'm beyond, you know, thinking that this is just completely insane. Might as well just go one step further to see if I can see anything. So I had a TV with one movie and I had a laptop with two movies all playing at the same time with no sound. And I put on Pink Floyd's album, Dark Side of the Moon. So I'm watching three different sets of images and I'm listening to one album and I start to see something interrelated between two of the movies, but I can't watch all three at the same time. It's just too much information. Right? There's just too much information going on, and my brain kind of starts to shut down. To take another long story short, I ended up playing on a screen on the TV, 2001 A Space Odyssey, and on my laptop below it, The Shining. And I was listening to Pink Floyd's album, The Wall. And something uncanny jumped out of the screen. The music and the images fused in a way that after about a couple of days of tinkering and aligning, I found 82 minutes, which is the length of the album, The Wall. So 82 minutes of The Wall, 82 minutes of 2001, and 82 minutes of The Shining, when viewed in this arrangement that I describe at my blog, it is its own little film. It works not as like an uncontrollable chaos. Like I said, you have to see it, and I'm not going to pretend to explain it for you. You can go to my blog and read about it if you want to do this thing yourself. But
what's the link to your blog, by the way?
It's IAHUASCA.blogspot.com. Ayahuasca.blogspot.com. Anyways. So I have two movies, one album aligned, and it's not chaos. There's a poetry to it. There's a beauty to it. There's a narrative to it because the words and the music of the album are sort of explaining what's happening on the screen. Now, again, I can say that this makes sense, right? Just like somebody with a doctorate can say, Finnegan's Wake has a narrative. I don't know if you've ever opened up a book like Finnegan's Wake, but it is almost impossible to read unless you have the keys to unlock the narrative. And this thing I call the Kubrick Transformer, you can dismiss it. just like they dismiss a book like Finnegan's Wake. But I truly believe that it demonstrates or is evidence of this mystery. It's something that is unexplainable. It's uncanny. It's filled with so many coincidences that coincidence no longer is the word that should apply. I think you need to imply a word by Carl Jung called synchronicity. These are meaningful coincidences that happen non-locally or non-temporally. They seemingly are disconnected or unconnected, but when they happen, it's undeniable the message that it's trying to talk to you about. So I've gone beyond coincidence now in this long journey into synchronicity. And this is where Alan Green comes into the picture. Alan Green put out a book called The Sync Book. I found out about Alan Green through a gentleman named John Kidd. He was one of the first people that I brought the Kubrick Transformer to. I told Mark LeClaire about the Kubrick Transformer. He didn't seem to really be too impressed by it. He wasn't as excited about it as I was. But he told me to contact John Kidd. He said he made synchronicity videos, maybe that we would begin a dialogue. I talked to John Kidd. I learned about Alan Green. I began a dialogue with Alan Green, explaining to him this whole thing about the Kubrick Transformer. And out of conversations with Alan Green, which were very informative, we began a really nice back and forth that led to ultimately to the formation of this podcast we do called Always Record, which is essentially a podcast. It's 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours of me, Alan Green, and another genius named David Plait, who's also known as MK Ultrasound, where we kind of recognized that whenever we were on the telephone or Skype talking, we thought, God, I wish we recorded that. I'd like to go back and listen to what you just said, because I wasn't taking notes, but we're obviously all studying the same things. There's something very informative there. I wish I could listen to it. And so I basically approached Alan and said, you know, you're being interviewed on all these different shows and the interviewers aren't really asking you very good questions. It sounds like you're going through the motions every time you go through these different interviews. Why don't we just start our own radio station or our own radio show? And why don't we just talk about the things that we talk about when we're on Skype or we're emailing each other? And why don't we record it and call it a show? You know, if no one listens, big deal. Not, you know, no harm, no foul. But let's just get it out there in the internet. Let's just make it, give the people an opportunity to listen to these conversations. And also, I'll benefit from recording it because then I can go back and kind of review the topics that we addressed, and I can become better informed by that. So this, if anything, this Kubrick Transformer thing that I came up with, it brought me to Alan Green's front door. We developed this podcast called Always Record. There are 56 different episodes up at thesyncbook.com. It allowed me to get on 42 Minutes, which is a great podcast by Doug Bowles and Will Morgan. You can find episodes of 42 Minutes up at thesyncbook.com. And this Kubrick Transformer got me an invitation to be in the Sync Book Volume 2, which is obviously the second volume of the Sync Book, where different authors relate their stories and their experiences with synchronicity and what it means to them. So basically, this whole turn on, tune in, drop out, find the others, and then tell your story. And that's really all that my work has been about, has been this long process of going from instant karma and opening my eyes to the universe to, instead of just taking in media, actually putting out media. A strange journey, my friend.
Well, that's alchemy, isn't it? You know, when you bring things together from different things and you make a whole. It's otherwise known as alchemahole. And we'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com with William Klaus. Don't you go anywhere, folks. Divided we fall. Unity, please don't desert me.
Uh-oh. Speedway rappers, but I've never never been edible. I'm a cracker, not a vegetable, fed to an extraterrestrial. The beat is so electrical, it'll pump your heart ventricles, but I bet you will eject it if I start getting intellectual. I am
Welcome
not
back.
Incredible, so until I can say I'm credible.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that is not credible, but is definitely incredible, like an edible extraterrestrial. And my very special guest is William Klaus. Welcome back. Now, we've only got about 10 or 12 minutes or something like that to wrap up the show here, like the mafia wrap up a body in a carpet. So go for your life. What is it that you'd like to share with us now?
Essentially, so this is my journey, you know, and this is where I've been and where I am now. I think the Sync community, which is basically what it can be known, you know, a lot of people know the name Jake Kotza, a brilliant guy. There's so many people out there who I could say, Alan Green, David Plate, Will Morgan, Douglas Bowles. I'm going to forget all of you, Sybil Hunter, Mark LeClaire. We're under this umbrella. Alan Green has put out 2 books of the Sync book. 26 authors in each book. There are 52 different voices, basically, who have wrestled with this mystery in their lives, and they put themselves out there to talk about their experiences, how they process the experience, what their theory is. And really what it's all about for me is sort of when you open the mind's eye, you know, and you open the doors of perception and you reveal that lens, there's a lot of smudge on it. You know, Philip K. Dick wrote a book called Through a Scanner Darkly. Synchronicities are these little sparkles that direct you in the ways that you should go about polishing that lens, to clearing it so that you can see the universe more directly, become more in tune with what it is that what it's all about, essentially, right? So, you know, I mentioned Philip K. Dick. He's, I think, a person who suffered greatly from not living in the internet age. He's a great science fiction writer. He writes – his novels meant a whole lot to me because they deal with madness. And that's probably the one ingredient in the story that is apparent, but, you know, the pain and the cruelty that the universe can sometimes inflict upon you, that's everyone's got their share. So I'm not going to sit here and cry and whine about it. But Philip K. Dick.
You're not going to sit around here like Ayahuasca the Grouch.
But Philip K. Dick informed his novels with the individual in a universe that changes suddenly and how they go about trying to put it all back together. And synchronicity is one of these tools that I think people should know about so that they, when the universe does change on them, because it does happen, it's a tool, a very powerful tool for trying to put the pieces back together again. Basically, I've been recently reading these selected letters of Philip K. Dick. And the way things work, it's just bizarre. I was invited to interview his ex-wife, Tessa Dick, and I was also invited to interview David Gill of totaldickhead.blogspot.com. And basically, this is my final sort of message with synchronicity and what I'm coming to understand just exactly what synchronicity is it's the Holy Spirit. It for me, you know, it's in my individual world, is I go back to sort of that Catholic operating system. Everything, it goes in circles and cycles, and I reconnected with that Catholic teaching of the Trinity, you know.
Oh, my God. That's exactly what I've been thinking about these last couple of months as well. It's like it's coming back in a circle for me, back to my Catholic upbringing. I'm becoming kind of like a more Christian, and I'm like, whoa, how did that happen?
It's phenomenal. And this understanding of the Holy Spirit is something that really isn't discussed in most Catholic education and in the Mass. But Philip K. Dick wrote a lot about the Holy Spirit. You know, it's also known as Sophia, wisdom, or the logos, or as I like to call it, or as someone put more accurately, the living word. What is the living word? The word is communication. Voices speak words. This is the voice of God that's being communicated through our universe. We're saturated in media. Why can't God speak through media, right? It's when you get deep into this connection and deep into this understanding, it's nice to find something like the Holy Spirit instead of something like Satan, you know, because I think ultimately you come to this fork in the road with this kind of research and this kind of mystery, and you can either decide it's all evil, that the universe is here to grind you up and spit you out, that it's here to destroy you, that death is certain for everybody, and that this is just a bad place. And I certainly felt like that might be true. I've spent weeks in that mindset where that was true, you know. But I've even when that was true, I still made it through the day and kept going forward. And to now, my understanding is, you know, the sinking is everywhere. You know, you can see this Holy Spirit in everything if you only have the lens to see it. But it's the polishing of that lens. It's the work that you have to do to make sure that your lens is as clear and as precise as it can be, that you can start to see that. And I
reminds me of something that Bill Hicks said. He said watching television is like taking a black spray paint can and spraying it over your third eye.
Right. No. But I think there's great work done by people who will tell you, no, you can still see that in television, but you have to change the sense ratios of your mind. You have to get educated. You know, you can't say, I didn't like math as a kid. You know what? Just because the educational system wasn't able to teach you calculus by the age of 17 doesn't mean you can't learn calculus by the age of 30 or 40 or 50. But if you upload calculus into your brain, you're going to see the universe differently. And you owe it to yourself to not say, you know, my educational system was a piece of crap. It didn't understand me as a person, and it wasn't able to teach me calculus. I have that ability. I'm a human being. Calculus is something that human beings came up with. It's a revelation of a cosmic order. And go take a class or go on the internet and find how to learn how to do calculus. If you don't know how to do calculus and you don't know how to do algebra, start with algebra. Do geometry. People called it sacred geometry for a reason, because it opened up the universe. Believe that you are smarter than your original operating system. Believe that you are smarter than what they tell you on television. Challenge yourself every day to take on these cognitive challenges to sharpen your lens and become more powerful and more in control of your destiny. And it's, you know, a sappy message maybe. But usually that, you know, I've just found out that stuff tends to turn out to be true. And, you know, be brave enough to look like a fool, be brave enough to be sappy and corny, laugh at yourself every day. This is just what I've learned.
You know, I appear to have gotten it down.
Well, I mean, you've got the greatest hair in radio, right?
It's true. I don't have a face for radio. Sorry.
But, you know, as I've been on this podcast, I've done this blog. I was invited onto Red Ice Radio to do an interview. And what's amazing when you put yourself out there, people will attack. They'll tell you that you're crazy. They'll tell you that they're wrong. Some people might even tell you that you're part of an MK Ultra propaganda machine and question who your handler is and who you're working for. There's a lot of angry people out there. And that's just because they're frustrated beyond anger with the position they are in their life at this moment. And their lens is a little too clouded, and they're not seeing the beauty and the joy or the Holy Spirit that's surrounding them. And you got to be patient with these people. And I don't think I think you need to be strong enough to enter into a dialogue with these people and to continue to kind of listen to their tortured message and try to pass on a little bit of humor. pass on a little bit of understanding, reflect upon where maybe I was at that point in my life, and to try to even share the time with the people who see, you know, like I said, there is conspiracy, but conspiracy isn't in everything. It isn't in my work. I'm just a dude who's telling you where I am right now and where I've been and where I might be going. And, you know, if you're seeing a conspiracy in the work that I'm doing or the work of Alan Green with Sync Book Press, I'm just, you know, you're just, I think you're in the wrong place, you know?
Yeah. I do think that what happens is when you get into the idea of conspiracy, you begin to believe that everything's a conspiracy. And what's interesting is if you don't believe in conspiracy, you believe that people who do believe in conspiracy think everything's a conspiracy. And people who come to this, Vinny, you think everything's a conspiracy? I say, no, not everything's a conspiracy, just most things. You know, occasionally there'll be things that aren't the result of a complete and utter scumbag kind of thing. There's plenty of genuine people out there who just, you know, get stuff wrong or whatever. It doesn't mean they're part of MK Ultra, that they're a Delta or a Beta or a Theta or a Sata or a Satan or something like that, you know. Who cares? Well, what have these people got going on in their lives? And the answer is they don't have a whole lot going on in their lives. That's the problem. It's because you try to live your life vicariously through other people's experiences, other people's research, and you ain't got nothing of your own to contribute, so all you do is repeat, attack, and push out. And you got nothing to push out with, okay? Go out there, do something of your own. And here's the point, and I think you made this point earlier. Turn on, tune in, drop out. What do you do after all of that? You go and find some people. You find the others, man. I've seen this happen to a number of truthers, bro. Who they wake up to the New World Order, they start exposing scumbaggery, and they don't find anybody who agrees with them, so they become bitter, and they wind up hating humanity as a result. All right, William Klaus has been my very special guest, ayahuasca.blogspot.com. Go and check it out, and we'll see you again sometime, folks.